We made this.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney. This week's episode is another podcast that was intended to air as part of my friend Tony Black's show, The New Wave. However, if you listen to our last episode, you'll know that Tony has, for the time being at least, decided not to go forward with his series, despite recording a few episodes. Therefore, because a couple of the films he podcasted about fit in quite nicely with the Movie Palace, I agreed to air them here to ensure that Tony's good work doesn't go to waste. So today you're going to hear a discussion about Norman Jewison's 1967 film In the Heat of the Night. Tony is joined by Russ Hugo, who long-term Movie Palace listeners will recall from my episode on The Day the Earth Stood Still some time ago. So without further ado, let's hear what Tony and Russ thought about In the Heat of the Night.
In the Heat of the Night was released in cinemas on August 2nd, 1967, directed by Norman Jewison from a screenplay by Sterling Siliphant, based on the novel of the same name from 1965 by John Ball. In the film, Sidney Poitier stars as Virgil Tibbs, a black detective from Philadelphia who, while waiting at night for a train in the small Missouri town of Sparta, ends up booked by local police under suspicion of the murder of a local white businessman. Upon meeting Police Chief Gillespie, played by Rod Steiger, Virgil is recruited by the deeply prejudiced Southern policeman under duress to help them catch a killer amidst the stifling heat and horrific racial prejudices of small-town America. So, I mean, I'll open the floor up to you then, Russ, to start off with. Why don't you tell me what your first experience with The Heat of the Night was, and generally, what do you think about the movie overall?
So, in all honesty, I had seen the film, I believe, when I was much younger, probably maybe 8 or 9, and at that point, you don't really pick up the themes and found it relatively boring, I believe, is my recollection. And I also grew up being around the television show and having a similar feeling about it. But I've also been appreciative of Sidney Poitier's work a lot and wanted to revisit this. And this was a good excuse because this is something in his filmography that I had not revisited in the past few decades with a more fresh adult perspective, and was just looking forward to doing that.
The film in general, then, are you a fan of it? Did you enjoy it? Because obviously, by the way you're sounding it, you've seen it years ago, but in a way, I guess this would have been almost like the first time round again. So, did you get a lot out of it, this sort of mixture of first and second time?
That's very fair in the sense that it is almost like watching it for the first time, and I got a lot out of it. I'm going to say I loved it. It's not a perfect film by any means, and there are very few ones that are, but I think it has a lot of rough corners compared to a lot of Hollywood classics. And I think that's what brings out, I think it's what makes it a particularly interesting film, is that how many flaws it has, and yet it's still technically or flow or other things like this. And that's maybe a bit harsh of me to even say flaws. A lot of these things are subjective, but it's a very loosely structured and put together film, fairly chaotic in some ways and in some issues. And despite that, works so well in the areas that really count, in the human drama aspect, in the atmosphere. It's exceptional. I really liked it. How about you?
A similar story in a way. I remember catching, I think, bits of it years ago, but it had been a long time since I'd seen it. And I don't think I've ever sat through until recently and watched this fully. But it was always a film that was on my radar because I am, the reason obviously I'm doing this podcast is I'm particularly interested in American history in many ways, and certainly how cinema interacts with that history. And this is, you know, it's a really sort of key film for not just the start of the sort of new Hollywood movement, but also how it intersects, and I dare say we will talk about this later, but how it intersects with the civil rights movement and, you know, the Black Power movement and all these things that were going on at the time in the late 60s, you know, Martin Luther King and all that stuff. And the role of Sidney Poitier as this quite iconic film character who has, to some degree, passed down the ages, maybe not to the same extent as other sort of 60s iconic recurring characters, particularly James Bond, for instance. But Virgil Tibbs is, certainly in America, I think, still a recognised character. So it's quite an important film for in multiple ways, really, as well as being really quite innovative for its time in what it was doing. So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I found it to be a quite intense, but also quite... It's a thriller, but it's more of a mystery drama. It felt much more of a detective drama while having a underbelly to it, a real deeper level of threat and danger and that sweltering sense of something brewing socially and culturally underneath, which distinguishes it from being just a normal cops chasing a bad guy story, which, without getting ahead of myself, is exactly what the sequels end up being. So, you know, it really did something for me there. And I think it's anchored by two particularly, I think, tremendous central performances.
Well said. And I'm sure we'll kind of get into both those performances. And even the supporting cast in general does a very good job. And you touch on some of the atmosphere and the threat. And that is something that I really took away from the film, was the tension and the way it presents these racial... Boy, I wonder... I mean... Prejudice seems like a very soft word here, but the way it presents the terror of this situation, of the social situation at the time, it feels surprisingly restrained in modern contexts, in that there aren't a lot of tricks to heighten, and the director pulls some punches in some places that I found really interesting, and other places where it let it flow a little bit more. And I don't mean to denigrate one or put one over the other, but I think a modern take on this film would heighten certain scenes so much that it could border on where you're kind of getting a highlights reel of the race experience in the United States. Something, you know, maybe like, you know, Django Unchained or 12 Years a Slave might do. And there's a place for that. But I feel that this creates an atmosphere of palpable tension that feels like a common everyday presence in reality, if that makes sense, as opposed to kind of seeing like an extreme moment in an extreme place in history or an example of extreme suffering and we're going to dwell on it. This has this degree of ambiguity of all times, and that's where I think Poitier's performance shines so well, and seeing somebody who has developed the skills to survive in this atmosphere, which is, it just provides, even in the thing, these moments of calm, there's still this tension that isn't overplayed by the soundtrack or anything else, and just allows the atmosphere and the other characters to let it cook. And that's my main takeaway and praise. There's a lot to praise about the film, but that's something I thought it was exceptionally important about for the era and also for modern viewers.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think it's got a real... The difference between some of the other things you mentioned, citing, you know, Django Unchained and those kind of films, is that they approach the idea of deeply ingrained prejudice with a hyper-real sensitivity, particularly Django Unchained. Whereas, as you say, this is baked into the very fabric of the world that Virgil ends up in. And that, I mean, that's the key to the whole story. And there is there's a particularly interesting moment where, when they were showing the film in test screenings, and what they would tend to do is they would play films like this in a city environment, in a cinema. I think in this case it was in San Francisco. And they would tag it onto the end of another picture, and then they would play it at the end, sort of late at night. And they'd have a very, you know, modern sort of liberal audience in there, and they would offer to play this film as a test screening, and they would do that. And they did this with the film, and Jewison was there, as well as Hal Ashby, who was the editor, who was almost as involved as Norman Jewison in making the film in many ways. He was a really integral part. And they were watching the film, and one of the key scenes, obviously, is when Virgil is brought in. to the police station and he first meets Gillespie, there is the moment where Gillespie says, well, what do they call you up north or something like that? And he says the famous line, they call me Mr. Tibbs. And this is after they've said, well, who are you? And he says, I'm a police officer. And at both of those lines, the audience erupted with laughter. Erupted. And Jewison was mortified. And he was absolutely mortified. And he said, well, why are they laughing? You know, what? This isn't funny. Like, this is awful, what they're suggesting. And that he's... The whole line, they call me Mr. Tibbs, which has reverberated through history, is very much the point of that line. And the reason that Poitier emphasises Mr. is that in the North, they have respect for him like they have respect for a white man. And that he is a man of stature. He's a police officer. He has a respectful job and a career. And in this world, he is nothing. You know, he's something that would be shot on the street. So he couldn't understand why they were laughing. And Hal Ashby, who was far more involved in the sort of late 60s movement at the time. He was a big hippie, wore his long hair, you know, down to his shoulders. He was doing LSD and all this kind of thing. And he was like, listen, man, they're laughing at the lunacy of him having to defend himself like this. They're not laughing at the situation. They're not laughing at the situation. They're laughing with the situation. They are in a position of, I can't believe these people are behaving like this, and this policeman has to justify himself in this way. And he didn't realise that at first. And I think that's a key example of how the film is really, with the dialogue, with what it's doing, is tapping into this reservoir of two very different worlds. And in this film, I mean, you never see the North. You know, you never see the North. But this is one of those films where you really... It really presents an America, which is one of literally a Civil War inspired dividing line. You have the civilized North, where there is tolerance, there is progression, there is, you know, social movement, and then you have this place. And Sparta represents just the worst, the worst kind. From our modern eyes, it represents somewhere awful, like so detached from the reality of where Virgil comes from, it's almost hard to believe. I mean, you live in America, and I'm aware that America is vast and not everyone knows every part of it intimately well. But I'm guessing you think that this, what it's saying in those kind of moments, is just as powerful now as it was in 1967.
I think it is. There's a lot of stuff in there, you know, to unpack. I mean, one caveat that is important to be careful about is, while even at the time there was more progression and more integration in the North, it would be hard to say, in the sense there's even less discrimination. I guess there is. There's less violence, less things like lynching and stuff, but there was still progression and segregation in different forms and happening in different ways that were harder to see. And that's what I find to be fairly interesting and educational, is that you can see, if you take something like this film, which isn't as heightened, but it's this present tension, you get a lot more cues and things that you might pick up in other experiences, whether through media or the rest, that might portray racism or discrimination, or not even portray it, but it's just embedded in it throughout the rest of the United States. One caveat as an example, is I grew up in very much in the North, in the Pacific Northwest, but I grew up in a small town. It was for where we were, because it was lower working class, fairly diverse. Fairly. I mean, it's still probably 80% white. But there, you know, this was in the 80s and 90s, and you'd still hear stuff. Nothing is extreme like this at all, but there were a couple kooks around town that, you know, made you a little scared, that think, are these people, do they have like a KKK hood or something in their back closet? But one thing I grew up in, I remember there was a scandal a while back where somebody, I think, referred to Obama as boy in a term, in some phrase, and it erupted, and I did not get it at first. I didn't understand the cultural nuance and realized I completely missed that context. And then watching this film, all I would have to do is actually just watch In the Heat of the Night, and that all comes very clearly. And that was my takeaway on the Mr. Tibbs line, where he emphasizes Mr. is because they keep calling him boy and denigrating him and, you know, trying to relate him to a subservient juvenile and all of these things. So, yeah, it's a very powerful film today. It's one of those things, without going off on too many tangents, but we're still in the United States, or I'm sure in many places in the world, but speaking as a U.S. citizen, still dealing with the concept of race and discrimination in a chronological context. I think our country now has a problem of compartmentalizing things in the past and not being able to look at continuity, not being able to look at the effects of these policies on the present, but also the continuation of these forms and ideas in our present world in a way that isn't cartoonish. I think people could say, oh yeah, we got a couple of KKK members or something like this, but they don't. It's difficult, I think, for a lot of Americans, or at least political movements, to really connect and empathize with the realities of what happened in the past, A, and then B, how it affects the present, because both of those things are crucially important. And this film, I found, was really effective as a U.S. viewer for kind of stirring up those thoughts and being able to kind of ground you in a visceral sense that when I left the film, you can connect with it. Doesn't feel trapped in that film, if that makes any sense, because of, I think, the audio design and the sweltering atmosphere. It could have been played up even more in the sense there's a place, it is the South, I get it, but it feels, you know, I've done a little bit of traveling around the South. I have friends who live in the South. I have a relative who spent the entire time in Florida, and they tell me stories that make me think that there are still many people who hold these attitudes in that area and express them. I'm sure there are people who hold those attitudes in the North as well, but it's the expression of them so openly that I think makes the regions distinct. That's my long rambling, and I apologize.
No, no, it's great. I think you're absolutely right in that one of the things I got from what you're saying there particularly is that there is always a level of nuance in how tolerant areas of any country are. And I think it's definitely not as clear as to say the South is awfully racist and the North is perfect and, you know, tolerant, because that's never quite how it is. But I think In the Heat of the Night really, certainly in both the film and the book, very much present this world as being one that is living in a very dark part, or living in the shadow of a very dark part of America's history, or the particularly troubling relationship that white America had with black America going back hundreds of years. And I think that is really powerfully rendered at a point where there is a lot of change going on. And I think the film is a key marker for that in many different ways. The book is interesting, though. Am I right in thinking that you haven't read the book?
I have not. No,
I did give it a read, so I can say a little bit about John Ball's book,
please.
Which is I loved it. I thought it was a great read, actually, and it's got its detractors, and, you know, I think quite a few people find its fairly blunt, slightly pulpy dialogue and presentation a little bit on the nose. It's not the most, I would say, elegant book ever written. It's not necessarily the most, you know, beautifully constructed book ever written, but I thought it was really effective. And it presents a really interesting, well-told story, the core of which is the same, in that the reasons for the murder, and obviously we're assuming you've watched In the Heat of the Night, so we're going to talk about the plot. But in the film and in the book, The key reason for the murder, it involves a young teenage temptress called Dolores Purdy, who frames essentially the cop Sam Wood, played by Warren Oates in the film, for the murder at the beginning of the film. And it turns out that it's part of a web in which the killer, Ralph, who's this local guy who runs like a convenience store or a diner, or works there at least, with low intelligence, accidentally sort of kills this guy in order to get some money to help pay for the abortion for this girl that he's got pregnant. So it's in, and that has its own level of social, you know, interesting social aspects to it itself. So it's not necessarily, the actual resolution of the murder is not as cut and dried as there is a terrible killer out there. It's a little bit, so those are the same. The book does the same thing for both of those things. The changes come particularly in how, well, firstly, how Virgil is presented more than anything else. Because in the book, he is what was described as the sort of the perfect Negro character. The exceptional Negro, I think that the term was in study circles. And it's this concept that the character of Virgil is essentially perfect. He doesn't get angry. He doesn't. He gives everyone the space in order to air their awful views and to call him a word I won't repeat, but I will refer to it as the N word. I'm not going to say it on the podcast, even though it's all over the book and it is a little bit in the film. But you all know what I mean, and I'm not going to say it on the show. But yeah, the N word is thrown at him constantly and all kinds of slurs, and he takes it and he reacts in the most dignified, noble, and supportive way you could imagine. In the book, it is, if you read it, it is a little bit beyond belief in a way. So the difference that immediately happens, and he sort of is presented as like, he's almost like a black Sherlock Holmes. He understands this. He very quickly intuits. He picks up details. He can make leaps of logic that no one else can. And yeah, even though he's surrounded by all these Southern cops and they're a little bit dumb, quite a lot of them, he still looks like he's streetwise, streets ahead. So there is a sort of disbelief aspect to the character of Virgil in the book. And the difference that was made immediately to the film is that Poitier wanted to make him angrier. Poitier wanted to have underneath, cooking within Virgil, this sense of deep resentment at the way he was being treated, and frustration and simmering resentment. And even though, yes, he's the smartest man in the room, sure, in the film, I don't know about you, Russ, but I didn't get the sense that he was like a Sherlock Holmes. I got the sense that he was a cop in a more liberal area who's coming to this world and hates everything he sees. And he doesn't want to be there, and he wants to get out of town as quick as he can, but he doesn't have a choice. So he is in the film much more of a reluctant hero. And without, I know you haven't read the book, but I wonder what you think in terms of whether or not that makes him more of a compelling protagonist.
It saves the film. I couldn't imagine it the other way. I don't think we'd still be talking about it today if it wasn't for that, to give that the nuance, because it has to contextualize the character. It makes the character then feel like it's in a real world, and it makes it feel like the real world. It gives both a lot more for Poitier and Steiger to do and to play with in their relationship and the nuance there. And yeah, I think it's also the fact that the character is fallible, and I don't know how much of that was Poitier's writing, but there are a few things, you know, makes mistakes because of anger. It's not simply this underlying thing, but there is this limits to how much restraint. And I think that adds to the threat, because you don't know how much the character can handle. And it allows, I think, the viewer to empathize, because in some of these situations, you're thinking, wow, how much restraint would anybody be able to do? And then that provides a lot of space to deal and think about a lot of the issues it presents. On that topic, I'm wondering if in the book, does the meeting with Endicott play out the same way? And I specifically refer to the talk about the orchids and the allusion to eugenics and talking about the Negroes and needing nurturing. And I wondered, because that seems to really point back directly to Poitier's recommendation to change the character from the exceptional Negro stereotype. and that being a very highlighting why that would be problematic. So I'm curious if there were any differences.
It could not be more different, Ross. It's interesting. As you were saying that, I was saying I'm going to bring up the Ender cutscene because that is a very clear example of how differently they approach this. In the book, Endicott is a very liberal man who lives with his wife in a house, and the man who is killed is an Italian visiting conductor, and even the town has changed. The town in the book is called Wells in North Carolina, but they changed it to Sparta, Missouri, because when they were location scouting for a town that would fit, they happened upon Sparta. And because they were operating on a limited budget, they couldn't afford to paint the signs to say Wells, North Carolina. So they decided to change the location to where they were filming. So Sparta is actually a real place in Missouri that they filmed in. They did that because, and I am veering off topic, but I will get back to this. They did that because when he signed on to do the film, Sidney Poitier refused to film in the south of the country for reasons I'll talk about when we talk about Poitier soon. He said, I'm not going beyond the Mason-Dixon line, so I'm not doing it. So you need to find somewhere that is like that, but is in the north. So they did, and that's where Sparta came from. So, yeah, in the book, he's a visiting Italian conductor who comes to Sparta as part of a way to regenerate the town. So it's obviously there's economic issues, like there are in the film. But in the film, they replace this guy with a white businessman who is building a factory. And obviously in the film, the question marks around the death are whether or not the fact he was planning to employ, you know, what was it, 500 Negro workers is a reason that maybe he was targeted and he was killed because they didn't want that influence, that black influence on the town. So, but again, it's a similar kind of economic idea. This guy was coming in to regenerate the town, and the widow, played by Lee Grant, she only has a couple of key scenes, but she's a key character because she says, if you don't investigate this with Virgil, I'm going to pull my factory out of the town. So they're beholden on an economic level to the regeneration of this town. So there's a lot of political stuff cooking underneath as well. As a side note, incidentally, Lee Grant had lost her husband like a year before. So she channeled a lot of that into her performance. She was from the Method School, like Rod Steiger. And she'd been blacklisted during the McCarthy hearings in the early 1950s. She had a promising career, but she'd been blacklisted. And Dewison, because he was very much on a progressive stance, he decided to cast her in this role, particularly based off the back of her husband's death, not in a mercenary sense, but she was able to channel a lot of that grief into the performance, which is an interesting fact. So yeah, he's a different character. The Italian conductor's brought into the town. And he's got a daughter, the Italian conductor in this. I think his name's Manzoli or something like that. He's got an Italian daughter who is living with the Endicotts at the time, and they're staying with the Endicotts. So they're very much liberals. They are helping Virgil and everyone try and find the killer. And I think it's Duana Mantoli, the beautiful Italian daughter, she sort of falls in love with Sam, the cop. And in the book, Sam Wood has much more of a bigger role than Warren Oates was given. That's transposed to Rod Steiger for Gillespie in many ways, which is the right choice for the film. But in the book, a lot of it takes... But the key thing with the book... Sorry, Russ, I am going off on tangents here, but I will get back to the point. In the book, the film is never... That's the other thing with how the book is different and how Virgil fits into the exceptional Negro type. Because in the book, he's never characterised. You never, ever get any internal monologue with Virgil, ever, in the book. He's just there and he comes in and he does his thing and he goes. Everything is from the perspective of pretty much Gillespie, Sam Wood, and maybe someone like Duana at times, or some other people. It's never from Virgil's perspective. It's from the perspective of the racists, essentially. The racists who ultimately come to see Virgil's, you know, as a good man, as just like a white man. And that's the key in the book, in that Sam Wood is particularly that avatar who works with Virgil, and he has a transformative relationship with him, and that is what happens with Gillespie more in the film. So yeah, getting back to the point is that these are the key changes that change the story that facilitate the Endicotts being more of that liberal kind of figure. There is no figure in that book that fits the Endicott in the film, the role that Larry Gates plays, of this colonial man who literally has black people picking cotton in a field because it's that much of a, you know, a key thing to point out. There is nothing like that scene in the book. And that scene, I think, is one of the key, it might even be the key scene of the film, where Endicott slaps him when he tries to question him as to where he was when the murder was happening, and Poitier whacks him back in the face. I mean, I think that's amazing. That made me gasp. 50 years on, I did a whoa when I watched it. I think it's amazing. It's an amazing moment.
I was reading an anecdote online about talking to the director, the screenwriter, going to some showings of the film, and that scene is how they were judging the metric of the proportion of black audience members and white audience members. When the first slap happened, when the second one happened, they heard lots of O's, that was white audience members. And if they heard lots of cheers, it was black audience members.
Yeah.
But it's hard to, I think, simplify to that level in the sense of, as a viewer at this point, you're so terrified for anything that's going to happen. And some of the symbolics heading up to Endicott's house, they could be a bit overt or on the nose, but I think they're done so quickly that, for example, the woman stands up and she's got a scarred face near the camera. It's given maybe half a second or a second of screen time, but that just cues so much that what you're in for with this individuality. And then you get the eugenics speech, and the slap is contextualized. It's placed at such a perfect area, and the timing between each slap and the silence, it is exceptionally staged and terrifying.
It is terrifying, because the way that Endicott slaps him is like he thinks nothing of it. It's like he does it all the time. It's just you will be in your place. I'm not even going to say anything. I'm not even going to get angry. I'm just going to slap you because you're out of line and you're a Negro. So for them, when Virgil whacks him back, he's look. And then you get that amazing moment, which was, well, the amazing moment where he turns to Gillespie and he says, "You saw that." And he says, "Yeah." And he says, "What are you going to do about it?" And the way that Steiger says, "I don't know," is incredible. It took Rod Steiger so many attempts to get that moment right. Mm. He agonized over that line. And I think for good reason, because I think he got it absolutely spot on in the end, because you really do get that sense that Gillespie has no idea what to do. Like he couldn't even in his wildest dreams imagine he would be faced with this situation, where on the one hand, he has this white, powerful man in the community who is essentially a colonial overlord. And on the other, he has an intelligent black detective who he has to appease for political reasons, for, you know, primarily. And he can't shoot Virgil. He can't put him in jail, you know. So what does he do? What does he do in this situation? And it's a brilliant moment for his character. I think it's a turning point for Gillespie in a way, because it makes him realise just what he's up against almost in terms of this, you know, push-pull between the if you want to be, you know, obvious about it, the North and the South, the progressive and the regressive.
And in a modern film, that would be a turning point where, racism is bad. But this film is a lot smarter in the way it plays that. And we don't have to go into that there, but I did want to really quickly bring up something that you highlighted about the book and the difference, and just reemphasize sort of what you were saying. And I think it was the right decision to shift it, to make Endicott this character, to bring in Cotton, to bring in the symbology. They have the black jockey statue, to bring in the factory, and that there's now this ambiguity. Is it an issue of, I don't want the local black population to get power through these jobs, or is it more of a matter of economics that you have somebody here who is exploiting this population? And that is the most necessary discussion, or I want to say it in the United States, I think anywhere, but especially in the United States. I can speak only primarily because I'm from here. You cannot divorce race and economics. We can't on any level, and too often we do, to our detriment, in everyone's detriment, especially the people who are subjugated and marginalized. It's an issue still ongoing, the effects of this, when we look at the immigration debate and even how the central left handles that. Without getting too political, they will often divorce it from economics and it's incredibly dangerous. And I'm very happy that the film takes the time to, you know, just put it there in our face. And in the film's context, it's fairly aggressive. I mean, it opens with the cotton, I don't know if that's a cotton gin or what that is, the machine that's shredding it, and then shows the hands doing the work. Is that a realistic scene of what would be happening? Would people still be picking cotton by hand like that in the 60s, late 60s? It's doubtful, but the imagery, it communicates enough quickly of what's really happening to the film's great benefit, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think maybe it leans in a little bit to... There is a little bit of an... Even though it is rooted in the late 60s, in terms of many of its themes and what it's saying, there is a little element, I think, to this story that doesn't necessarily place it in the year 1967. You know, I could imagine this being set in, you know, 1957 or 1947, necessarily. You know, and if there was, in any other world, this would have been a black and white movie. You know, in that one of the key things that they wanted to do was, they wanted, Haskell Wexler, who was cinematographer, wanted to shoot in colour, and he wanted to shoot in a very documentarian style, which is why you get a lot of 35mm close-up scenes in the cars, which was something they didn't really do. You know, a lot of handheld stuff, which is why you get this very sort of bleached, sort of steamy, sort of colorized hue to the lens, because he wanted to bring in this sensibility that it was almost documentary, and he had a background in documentaries, Wexler. So there was a documentarian feel in some senses to the drama in a way you didn't get before. You know, one of the key differences with this was that in terms of color historically, and we've talked about, you know, we've in previous episodes, we've talked about Point Blank. You know, we've talked about Cool Hand Luke, which are all in colour. You know, Bonnie and Clyde, they're all in colour. But a drama such as Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was made not long before this by Mike Nichols, is shot in black and white, because the colour historically, even up to this point, was used for big, lavish productions. You know, a big production that is a fascinating read to find out about that was happening around the same time is Dr. Dolittle. The original Dr. Dolittle, starring Rex Harrison. And that is a big colour production, an example of the kind of way they used to use colour. So in any other world, this would have been a black and white movie. And I think that would have taken some of the context away, but also it would have, if you did project this in black and white, I think you would see that this isn't necessarily, the only thing that maybe tips it maybe a little bit towards the late 60s is the sexual side of it, in terms of Dolores and Ralph and everything with that, which we'll talk about in a sec, I guess. But I think otherwise, you could have it. And the Endicott scene is a key example of that. You could have it happen at all kinds of points. And I mean, the key thing with that scene, after you get the slap, you have that wonderfully ambiguous moment as well with the old black butler, Endicott's old black butler, who just shakes his head. Now, there's a few interesting things there. Firstly, he was played by an actor called Jesper Hairston, who was, he lived to nearly 100 years old. He was like in his mid-60s at this point. He was a musician. He was an actor. He wrote the song Mary's Boy Child, believe it or not, which is random. Okay. So, yeah, he had a really sort of diverse career. And I think he was a long-time contributor to the show Amos and Andy as well. So he was, you know, he was well-known in a certain context while still being a minor actor in that sense. But He, even though it's been taken as ambiguous, he has gone on record as saying, for me, I was shaking my head at this old white racist. And the shake of the head was meant for Endicott at that point. And it was a point of saying, that was, no, you know, I'm not with you on that one. So I think in that sense, I don't know if you agree with me on this, but I feel like you could have set this almost in a different time, and the fact they don't necessarily have to root it in at this point gives it a different level of timelessness.
I think that's very fair, and if we touch on the TV show later, there's chronological playing there as well. You could set it in any time, but then also, to be fair, in the United States, there are places that still feel like that, at least probably in the 90s that I visited, that you're like, this place has been trapped in time since the 40s, both in infrastructure and probably communal values and things like that. So it works really well. And I think it helps the film be less dated for that reason. But your points are all fair. And I wanted to bring up on the documentarian angle, which really, I think, shines during the... where I think the film felt most bold for me as a film was during the original, the suspect chase and through the woods. And you could see a lot of lighting changes and lens changes. And there was a frame rate where they sped up to the taillight of Sam Wood's car when he originally finds the body. There's a lot of subtle looseness to the film and the editing that feels not like you're saying, it doesn't feel like a lavish feature production. There are some incredibly beautifully staged and blocked scenes, especially when they're at night and when there's a lighting for them to control. But for a lot of the daylight scenes, it definitely feels very documentarian. Even the going over through the cotton fields, heading up to Endicott's house and some of the other stuff. And then the scenes night and day are, to pardon the pun, night and day feeling when it comes to the cinematography. And that may come back to what you were discussing earlier.
Yeah, I think it does. I think he was definitely quite innovative. I mean, the opening shot of the train is the lights are actually through a screen door, believe it or not. He's shooting through a screen door and then he cuts to the shot of the actual train coming in. Mainly because they couldn't get a train. You know, they didn't have the budget to actually get a train. And there's the sequence where the chase you talked about, where the suspect, played in fact by a young Scott Wilson, who then went on to be in The Walking Dead, particularly in lots of other roles, and on The X-Files, actually, as you'll remember, as a big X-Files fan.
Horizon.
Horizon, the episode Horizon. That sequence where the train is coming, they just had to judge that when the train was coming. That train wasn't hired for the film. They just went for it because it was in the shot. So there's a level of guerrilla filmmaking to this, which is interesting. Even though you have, on the one hand, these two very famous marquee stars who've been around for years, but you have, on the other, a lot of up and... well, it's funny because they are up and coming and they're not. There's some interesting stuff about the background to this. All three of the key people who made this... well, in fact, all four of the key people who made this film were all in their 40s or 50s or very late 30s when they made this film. They weren't along the same lines as people like who were up and coming in terms of, you know, making innovative stuff, you know, like the George Lucases or the Martin Scorseses or, you know, those kind of people who were still fairly young, Steven Spielberg, all those kind of people who were at this point and they were starting to get into making television and movies. These guys have been around for a long time. Like Norman Jewison had been part of the studio system for quite some time. He'd been like toiling, making like Doris Day movies because he came down from Canada and he was signed by Universal and he's making fluffy Doris Day comedies, but he doesn't want to be part of the studio system. He has a very sort of an independent sort of mindset. And then he finally gets the chance to work with another key person in this, the producer Walter Mirisch. And he directs for MGM, he directs The Cincinnati Kid. And that is what sort of breaks him away from that trap of the sort of light, fluffy kind of work. And then he comes across Heat of the Night. So you've got this guy who... And he's coming off the back of another quite successful film called The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming. So that does well at the box office just before this film. So he's got a little bit of clout going into In the Heat of the Night, which he's developing as something that he's, I think, more proud of on a script level and on a production level, potentially, than anything he's done before. So this is kind of his signature. He's been around for ages, but this is his signature sort of first big movie in terms of, you know, putting his stamp on cinema. So you've got him on the one hand. You've got Hal Ashby, who goes on to be a recognised director, if not a massive name, but he's quite a recognised director at that point. But he's an editor, and he again has been around for quite some time. But and as I said earlier, he's a bit of a hippie and he's involved in this movement. But he himself is coming from an older period. And then you've got the writer, Sterling Siliphant, who was a TV writer for years. Very prolific TV writer. It got to the point where he was getting like $10,000 per episode writing a heavily like anthology series, you know, things along the line of like similar to like Twilight Zone at the late 50s into the 60s. So he's been around for years. He's a journeyman. And then he gets this gig when he writes a film called The Slender Thread, which is a film that Poitier stars in. But then he even though the film doesn't come out very good, he then he's sort of through his agent and things like that gets involved with Heat of the Night and starts to develop it. And then you've got Wexler, who himself is in his 40s and is, again, coming from this background of documentarian, background. So you have a real sort of confluence of people who are tapping in to this new era of filmmaking, this far more sort of guerrilla indie era of filmmaking, even though they come from different stylistic backgrounds. And it feels a little bit like this film, even though, yeah, it's not perfect and it is a bit rough around the edges. I think, A, that adds to a lot of its charm. And I think also it sort of felt like a group of people coming together at the right time to make a film that, in a way, even though what I just said about it being timeless, I think could only have been made at this point in this way.
I will echo what you said about it being rough around the edges helping the feel, 100%. In fact, some of the things that I think weak in the film are some of the more standard Hollywood stylistic things. And not that it's all there, but some of Quincy Jones's soundtrack is a little reminiscent of a lot of other films prior to this and around this that are, it's a little tropey at times. It's not that it's bad, but there's a little mismatch that I think takes away from some of the atmosphere at times that the filmmaking is trying to do. I think you're right in the sense of films attempting to do this now would not make these same decisions. I mean, there's a lot of modern directors that I can think of that would, I'm sure, be huge fans of this film, like Jim Jarmusch and some of the rest. But even then, I don't think without the energy of that time and the shift of technology, yeah, I agree. I just don't think it would ever be made even remotely like this nowadays.
Yeah, it would be a different animal, I think. And
I think acting, especially, I'm sorry to interject, but I think that is one of the major differences. I think a lot of those acting choices would not be done today.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the acting, because I think there's a lot of interesting stuff about Sidney Poitier particularly and where he was in the position he was in at this point, because he was well known, but he was well known for being the only successful leading black male actor in Hollywood ever. He was standing apart in that sense from everyone else. Through, you know, ever since he'd made his debut in No Way Out from Joseph Mankiewicz in 1950 when he was young, because he's still with us, Sidney Poitier. He's like 93 now and he's still going, which is great. So he's been there since, you know, the studio era into the 50s. So he's been making films for years, and he even wins an Oscar for a film called Lilies in the Field, which he stars with Anne Bancroft, I think it is, in the early 60s. But he keeps being typecast essentially in roles that sort of reinforce a little bit of that exceptional Negro kind of character. Or he's playing somebody who is virtuous. Virtuous to a degree that makes him almost a white man. I think, you know, in terms of the social mindset, you know, it's interesting that in 1967, there are two films, very big films that come out that star Sidney Poitier. One is In the Heat of the Night, and the other one is Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
And To Sir With Love, which is...
And To Sir With Love, which was a British... He hopped over to do that, I think, while he was waiting for In the Heat of the Night to start, actually. Hmm. He just hopped over to the UK. So, yeah, that's another example. But particularly Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Have you seen Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Once again, that was something I saw when I was a kid on daytime TV, staying home from school. So, yes.
Do you remember much about it, really?
Just the premise, and I need to revisit it. It's one of those ones I need to just catch up.
Well, it is a good film. Like, I watched it a few years ago, so I didn't watch it for this, but I did watch it a few years ago, and I really like that film. It is, you know, it's all about Sidney Poitier, and he's going out with Catherine Ross, and they go to, the whole premise is that they go to visit her parents, who are played by Catherine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy in his final role. He died soon after making the film. And they are, you know, wealthy, white, old people. And the whole thing is she brings home a black man to dinner. And the whole film is sort of set in one evening, I think it is, or one or two evenings. And his parents come over. He's black, respectable, very middle-class black parents. And it is all about the white people having to accept this this black man into the home. But the key thing is, in that film, Poitier is playing like a doctor. He's playing like somebody who works with the UN. So he is like this really shiny example. She might as well be bringing a white guy home. He just happens to be black. So the difference is that he keeps being sort of pigeonholed. He's getting quite frustrated by the point of The Heat of the Night. That, yes, his career is good. Yes, he's getting Oscar nominations. Yeah, he's getting feted quite a bit by Hollywood. Yes, him and Harry Belafonte, particularly at the time when they were friends, are getting involved in a lot of the, you know, civil rights movement, and they're doing things with Martin Luther King at this point, and they are attending certain events, and they're being asked repeatedly by the press, what do you think about, you know, Selma, which had happened, you know, the incident at Selma, which is brilliantly made in a film by Ava DuVernay, actually, with David Oyelowo in it. If anyone hasn't seen it, it's a great movie about Selma and the racial incident on the bridge and things like that. And there are riots going on in Detroit around the same time. So there's a lot brewing with the civil rights movement. So he is being asked this, and he's saying, look, I'm an actor, ultimately. I know I'm black, but I'm an actor. You know, ask me about the work. So he's getting more and more frustrated at him being an example of Hollywood's quote-unquote progressiveness. And this is a film that comes at the right time, I think, for him in terms of being able to make a film which is, yes, it's about race, but he doesn't play this perfect character. Yes, Virgil is the guy who helps solve it, but ultimately the key thing that is shared in the book is that Virgil gets it wrong, and he's trying to fit up the wrong guy. You know, in the book, it's a character who's not even in the film. It's the boyfriend of the Duane Mantoli character. But in the film, so he's keen to sort of, he's making it about trying to take down this old white racist, whereas in the book, it's more that he's trying to get the wrong guy. But they're both the same thing. He makes a mistake, ultimately, and that it only really gets resolved, to some sense, by luck. In the book, the details of it are a little bit more knotty, and there are other characters involved, and it all comes down to a piece of wood with blood on it and stuff like that. It's a bit more, you know, old hat. But one of the criticisms of the book at the time was that John Ball, who was a white guy, incidentally, was writing a Negro character at a time when change was happening that was completely out of step with actually what was going on, and that he was almost perpetuating a stereotype. As good a character that Virgil was, and he goes on to appear in, like, I think it's like 7 or 8 more books, he isn't really representing that, you know, that fury, that anger. And that's what Prote wanted to put into a role, and that's what this film affords him the chance to do. And that's why I think he's so good, because, you know, going back to your point about the acting, because he's bringing a lot of his own stuff, his own frustrations at his career, his own frustrations at the place, you know, in terms of his place in Hollywood, in terms of his race, into the film. And it shows. I think it shows. If you read that book, he's so much more placid. Tibbs has real fire in this film, and it's great. It's great to see.
Yeah, and the director feeds it, in the sense there's so many shots in this film where it just sits. And a lesser film might, or a lesser director might, make that, try to use the delay of the characters making actions or something that's over, making a decision. I want to think of somebody like Lynch, who will often do that for strong effect, but not for the sake of the acting, but simply for the sake of the direction and the pacing of the editing. And here, you just kind of feel as if the director is waiting for the character to make the decision. And it feeds on what Poitier and Steiger are doing. There's so many moments where it just sits, like where he comes to pick him up at the, try to coax him back at the train station. And it just is exceptionally well timed, and the actors just, yeah, sometimes letting the actors make that decision as opposed to the editor or the director pays off. And in this case, where you have the fire that's happening between Poitier and Steiger, it was the right call to let the film breathe how it needed to.
And Steiger as well was coming from a point of frustration, because he'd done a film for Sidney Lumet called The Pawnbroker a few years ago, and he was Oscar nominated for that. And obviously the key thing is he wins for Best Actor in this, or Best Supporting Actor, I think. Steiger, he wins the award. He doesn't think he's going to win, but he does. And he lost to Lee Marvin a few years ago for that film. And he goes off to Europe. He's married to Claire Bloom at the time, the actress Claire Bloom. And he goes off to Europe and he sort of says, I'm done. I'm done with Hollywood. I can't find what I want to find there in terms of enriching roles. You know, and this is a guy, remember, you know, this Steiger's by this point already he's very well known. He's very celebrated. You know, he's in films like On the Waterfront, you know, that brilliant Elia Kazan film from the mid-50s with Marlon Brando. So he's already a recognised, really good actor, but he's really disaffected. And he's brought back into playing Gillespie at a point where he's almost given up. So I think it's really interesting how he uses the opportunity to go into the method. You know, the whole idea of the as I mentioned earlier with Lee Grant, the technique that goes back to people like Lee Strasberg talking about really immersing yourself into a role by living that role in many ways. And he did do that while he was filming. He piled on loads of weight. He essentially carried on playing Gillespie. You hear this with loads of other actors, don't you? You hear it with Brando, you hear it with De Niro, you know, and that Day-Lewis, you know, they inhabit these roles in these movies, and they're doing it off screen as well. And all the actors are a little bit like, why are you still pretending to be a racist? So I'm in my method. But he does that, and I think he brings out, like, a key thing was the gum. Like, at first he didn't want to chew gum, but then it was a point that was added, and then he said, actually, chewing the gum allows me to get into the rhythm of his speech. It allows me to get into crucially, he would only stop chewing the gum when something shocking would happen, and then you see him stop chewing. It's like his comfort mechanism, Gillespie, at this point. So there's lots of really interesting things, and particularly the fact that Poitier didn't at first, he couldn't get his head around Steiger's method, because he didn't come from that school at all, and he found him hard to work with at the beginning. Like the scene, the Mr. Tibbs scene at the start, Steiger's playing it broad, he's playing it quite big, he's playing it quite over the top, and Poitier couldn't quite get a beat on it at first. And in a lovely moment of art imitating life, Ross, on Vice Versa, they bonded when they did the scene where Tibbs and Gillespie bond at the house. because they sat there, they drank whiskey, they did that scene, and Poitier started to understand how he did it. And they ended up being good friends by the end of that film, because he understood, he came to understand Steiger's method of acting. And I think Steiger really started to understand the anger that Poitier was feeling for the situation, to the point that when he goes up to the Oscars and he accepts his Best Actor, his actor award, Steiger, which was rare at the time, he does a bit of a political thing, and he says, "We shall overcome." You know, says thank you to Sidney Poitier for teaching me a lot about, you know, the world. We shall overcome. And it was a bit of a moment where they went, oh, he's bringing political stuff into this. And, you know, how many people after that took the lead there? That's a common thing now with the Oscars. So I thought it was really interesting how those two came together, almost like their characters do.
I'm happy to hear that, because the chemistry between the two actors is exceptional. And the film is good enough that it doesn't capitalize that in a crass way. We don't end up with a, you know, buddy cop film where the racist is all of a sudden this perfect saint who's crusading for civil rights. You know, the film plays it much more authentically, I think, and ambiguous. But it also lets the chemistry of the actors really flourish. I mean, not to harken back to your other podcast at the XCast, but it's what I think made Mulder and Scully so successful. As opposed to the will they, won't they be a couple, it's a will they, won't they reconcile. And the film doesn't exploit it. It just lets it be and to its extreme benefit, especially because both those performers can handle it. I mean, in, I think Poitier especially, he seems very youthful in the film compared to the character at first. And, you know, towards the end, when some of the more anger comes out, it kind of flows. But still, I don't know of too many performances I can think of where so much anger is communicated so well through the eyes, but the character still doesn't feel angry. That's not a note I'm going to ascribe to Tibbs, if that makes sense. He's not using it as a crutch for the character in any way, considering how often it's under the surface. It's exceptional. Mm. It blew me away.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Poitier should have at least, I think he should have won an award for this, because I think he brings, he like you say, it's a lot of it is in his face. Like, and that was one of the key things that Wexler wanted to do. He wanted to do a lot of uncharacteristic close-ups on Poitier, but they used to use certain colorized lenses that would sort of dapple the effect of particularly black faces. But with this, that he wanted a crystal clear look at Tibbs's face at various points, because Poitier does a lot with his eyes, he does a lot with his facial expressions, he does a lot with he scratches his face, he'll pull his eyelid down, he'll do a lot of rubbing with his eyes, he'll do a lot of ticks almost that really bring inflections to the character that show that bottled frustration at the circumstance he's in, that is really good, that he's really skilled, and he's really tapping into what the character is feeling. Like you say, without ever being truly angry, the angriest he probably gets is when he slaps Endicott. But even that is, it's not that he punches him in the face. He's like, how dare you? You know, it's more of a, when he gets slapped, it's like that flipped indignity. It's almost like back in the old days, if a black slave had slapped a colonial man, and the colonial man goes, whack, slap you back, the indignity, how dare you, the indignity. In this case, it's flipped. You know, Tibbs is indignant that he dares to slap him, and he slaps him back just reflexively. But it's not anger in the sense of, it's not played in that heightened way, which is where maybe Poitier was a bit underselling his abilities, because in some senses I think there is a level of method to what he's doing in this.
That's fair. Yeah,
it's whether he really understood that in the way before he got to know Steiger and his way of doing it, I suppose. But
there are moments, I think, like the Mr. Tibbs that feel very classical to me, but I think you're right that there are a lot of method elements, especially in his body. I think some more of his speech felt classical at times, but that I think also worked well. We have a character who's from the north, from the outside, coming in to the space. And that contrast works really well for the setting and the plot anyways, of the styles, I felt.
It's telling as well, just going back to the point earlier as well about how Poitier didn't want to film in the south. They did actually go to the south briefly, because one of the things that after the success of The Russians Are Coming, he, Norman Jewison, managed to get the film filmed in Spa. Originally, it was supposed to be filmed on a lot, Heat of the Night, and Jewison was saying, we cannot film this properly on a studio lot.
That'd be
we can't
insane.
Do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We have to go to a place that is reflective of where this is set. The setting is key. This sweltering, intense, you know, borderland of, you know, tension cannot be replicated. So after the success of, even though he was working on a low budget, I think it was something like $3 million, he was working on a low budget, Walter Mirisch, and they clashed a lot. You know, there was a lot of discord behind the scenes that Hal Ashby had to do a lot of negotiating with, I think, as well, while Jewison was off shooting things. But finally, Mirisch said, okay, you can shoot externally, you can go off the lot and do this. And that's when Jewison said to Poitier, look, I want to go into the south, I want to film it somewhere. And he said, no, I'm not doing it. But once they started filming, and they got to know each other and things like that, I think it was in order to film the Endicott sequences and find that colonial sort of era mansion, that they convinced Poitier to go to a town just over the border, I think, called Dyersburg. And it was almost like they were living the film, because there was only one hotel that would put them up, a Holiday Inn, which had because it was a chain, they had a policy of, you know, we will let black people stay, but nowhere else would let them stay. And they used to get rednecks in trucks circling the hotel. There was one drunk guy who sped into the the car park and started shouting. Poitier would sleep with a gun under his pillow. Like, because, and he said to Jewison, the first one that walks in here, I'm going to blow him away. And they very quick, once they realised that these guys were, knew that they were there, and they were, because more when movie crews usually turn up to towns, that people flock, people come and see what's going on. But once they found out it was Poitier, they didn't want to know. Nobody came. Nobody came to view, that look at the filming or anything. But the rednecks turned up at night looking for trouble, basically. So that's the point that they've sped up the filming and they got out of there as quick as they could. And that's quite astonishing to think, you know, that again is this fusion of what the film was doing and what was really going on and what they were sort of on that border of at that time. Scary stuff.
Definitely. And it comes through. And that's why, yeah, the film feels really authentic. I mean, it feels, the racism feels real. Like I was going, well, I was rambling about earlier about the authenticity of it. The unheightenedness, I guess is the word I want to say. But that those anecdotes are great. Oh,
it's crazy. What do you think about the, moving topics, what do you think about the side of it in terms of sexual politics then? In terms of Dolores and Ralph and Sam Wood and the whole accusation that Sam is, because he drives around and he sees Dolores naked in the window because she's an exhibitionist. She's this teenager, like 16. And that he in order to sort of protect Ralph, she just tries to finger him for the murder. What do you think about that side of this? Because obviously the film is so weighted towards the race side of things and the you know, that kind of clash. Is this in danger of sort of getting lost in the mix, in a way?
I think it is. I think it's completely lost in the mix. I think there are things they could have done more. I think it would have had to make it a longer film. And, I mean, it fits in the sense that it's a noir trope to some degree, and also the Southern Gothic stuff that's happening in Hollywood at this time. I mean, you've got eventually also... a Chinatown, and there's these other plays that deal with this stuff. With, and I forgot the character's name, the spouse of the murdered man.
Mrs. Cooper, is it?
Sounds right.
Something like,
yeah. I mean, they play a little bit there with the flip side and dealing with gender, and but they don't really question it too much and don't do too much in the sense that you here have a powerful woman in the South and what this is, what effects it's going to have. And I don't think it really does much at all with gender in ways that are, not to be harsh, but in anything that was really that interesting. There's a few tips on the nose at the very beginning with the, when we first see the character, we have the cop, Wood, driving, and he's got a statue of Jesus on the dash, and then looks in and the exhibitionist is there standing next to a sign that says, you know, Christ the Lord. And you've got this very much, oh, look, hypocrisy kind of angle happening that I was a little worried of, like, is this where the film's going to go? And that was later very much surprised pleasantly on how subtle in certain contexts it was, in places that I think were appropriate to be subtle. But when it came to the gender and sexual politics, it didn't, A, when it came to the woman who was performing the abortions, it didn't really deal with it too much. It was just kind of a stop note, and then, oh, we have the confrontation afterwards. And it isn't clear if the film wants to portray her sympathetically. It's more portrayed as a villain, but not really in any way that's sensible or matches with the tone. And then the interrogation scene with the young girl, in the, where she starts talking about the tombstones and the rest, it feels like it's coming from a different film. And it felt to me a little sleazy, would be the right word, maybe. I mean, that's not the right word. It's a bit harsh. It just felt like if this was a stage play, it felt like we were stopping and here's a different scene where somebody's going to come on and do it. It didn't feel like it was a part of the same film. And it also felt like, similar to the beginning, why is it here? There was no payoff, is what I'm going to say. It just made the whole murder mystery thing with Endicott even more muddled and disconnected. And there's a value to it being disconnected from the racial issues. But Yeah, I think it bit off a little bit more than it could chew. But that's my thoughts. What's your takeaway?
Well, I think you're right. I think honestly, I think this is one of the areas where I think it works better in the book, because in the book, it's you know, the book is fairly, you know, faithfully adapted in many ways, despite a lot of the changes, the incidental changes. But in the book, there is more to do with Sam Wood being, you know, fitted up as kind of like a you know, a predator, because she's more of a teenager in that book. In some senses, there is more about the, you know, the character of Duena, which is the other female, which is completely excised from the screenplay, is also sort of on the other flip side trying to figure out whether Sam is a predator or not. So it actually feeds in much more to the plot in the book than it does in the film. In the film, it's like, it's the resolution, it's the denouement. All the stuff leading up to that is all the racial, political stuff, you know. Like in the book, there is nothing like how when Tibbs is almost, he's run off the road almost and then chased into a factory by a bunch of rednecks who want to kill him. There's nothing like that in the book. That's all in the film. That's all in the film designed to amp up, you know, the tension and the paranoia, and also to allow Gillespie to come in and begin that bond process where he comes in and saves him, essentially. That's not in the book at all. The book is much more, I think, weaving in this idea of, you know, sexual politics and sexual corruption. Whereas I think the film sort of tags it on a little bit as a sort of a leaning nod to the sort of countercultural sexual revolution going on, even though Dolores is very much, you know, she's not in any sense a hippie. You know, she just happens, she's just white trash, basically, who is, you know, knocked up by a dumb guy who then kills a man, you know, accidentally in order to try and, you know, sort the problem out before her, you know, angry redneck dad, who is much more vile in the book, incidentally. He's not nice in the film, but he's awful in the book. He's like, it's terrible. There's so many instances in the book where when Virgil's in a room, these people won't talk. And there is a fair bit of that in the film, but in the book, it's all over the place. Get him out of here. Get that M-word out of here. And all this kind of stuff. A lot of that is toned down. And it was toned down because of the production code, because the established production code, which was sort of in its dying embers in terms of the, you know, the strict censors at the time, and they pared down the use of the M-word massively in this film, which I think is for the better. Don't get me wrong, I think that's a good thing. But they also made sure that Dolores, like in the book, you know, you can picture the naked, very buxom young girl, but in this, they obviously use the windows to block out her breasts, you know, and a groin. And even the scene where she takes the coke out of the fridge and she puts it between her breasts, they had to cut that, because originally she was going to nestle it between her breasts and sort of rub it up and down really seductively, and they cut that because the production code didn't want to know. So there were aspects where they pared a lot of this sexual stuff back in order to fit the censors, but also I think because they were angling it much more for the racial side, they were angling it much more to tap into this underbelly of racial tension. So I kind of wish, Russ, they'd have changed the ending, actually, and they'd have changed the denouement to make it more in line with the rest of the story.
I agree. I would have liked to have the ending be related to economics. And
yeah,
that would be the big curveball there. It would have been nice, because they had set it up so well and so nicely it could have been. And I would have felt better, too, about the gender stuff if they had some characters that were sympathetic or had a point to it. But the two women characters other than Mrs. Cooper, there's no audience sympathy generated for them in any degree. But, I mean, to be fair, there aren't many characters in the film at all that you have sympathy for, other than maybe car mechanic and maybe Scott Wilson's character at the cheeseburger scene, maybe.
Because that's the thing. I don't even think Virgil is necessarily that likable. Like, he's not... He's the hero, ostensibly, but he's not like a traditional sort of heroic, charming character. He's quite surly, he's quite angry, he's quite serious. Like, there isn't that same kind of character to root for in this film, which, again, I think makes it stand out, particularly at the time, you know?
Exactly, and I think that's one of the wonderful selling points of the film, is that you're introduced to this character who is thrust into a situation that is so awful that simply him surviving, outsmarting, and being just a decent human being is enough to make you absolutely care and sympathize with the situation. Yeah. And goes back to Poitier's goal of not making it an exceptional person. But let's also not even make him charismatic. And not that he's not charismatic. There are scenes where he is, but he doesn't lean into that. And Poitier could so easily. He's a naturally charismatic actor. And to be able to keep that cold facade, let the context highlight the situation and the sympathy. That then it goes back to creating sympathy for the every human.
So before we wrap up, just a few little things to tag on to the end of this. Obviously, this isn't the last time we see Virgil Tibbs. Obviously, in the book, there are multiple sequels that of the character, but in cinematic terms, he gets two more movies as a character, because at the time when United Artists were making these films and they were involved in the production of things, there was a lot of thinking about how well James Bond had done in the 60s and how you could have a recurring character. Because aside from certain, you know, there had been recurring sort of characters in films before, you know, going back to a lot of comedy sort of characters in the past and, you know, in the studio era of Hollywood, James Bond sort of broke the mold in terms of a leading man sort of action hero character who could appear in different movies. Granted, the Bond films don't have any continuity, film by film, really, particularly, but you had Sean Connery come back and do this again and again. And they were thinking, well, Goldfinger had been a massive success in 64. And after that, they said, right, well, we need to start looking for similar kind of characters. And because they knew that Virgil Tibbs had become a detective character in fiction, they said, let's do more. Let's get him in for more. So he gets two sequels. The first one is They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, which is based on the line we've talked about, in 1970, directed by Gordon Douglas. And the second one is called The Organization, in 1971, directed by Don Medford. And, well, I mean, I think we've talked about... I don't think you've seen these, have you, Russ?
No, I've not.
Well, don't change that. It's my advice. Because, like, well, The Organization is the better film of the two, by a fraction. But both of the films, what they do is they take Virgil, logically, I suppose, back to the city, and they set it in San Francisco, and he's back in his department, and he's working as a cop and things like that. And in They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, he's investigating the rather brutal death of a woman in like an apartment block. And there's various crooked kind of men involved and that kind of thing. And in The Organization, he's basically working with a bunch of immigrant sort of revolutionaries to take down this massive heroin smuggling organization. But it's done in a very sort of city-based urban environment. Even that broader story involving heists and things like that is done in a very sort of urban environment that borders on blaxploitation in a way, without being fully down the sort of shaft route in that same way. It's sort of a forerunner in some senses to that. It sort of bridges the two styles. But you realise that Virgil Tibbs only really works in the heat of the night because he's in that extraordinary situation and place. The moment you put him in a city and you have him working with other cops, and actually his race doesn't become any kind of point. You know, neither of those films are really about any kind of prejudice at all. He's just a cop working in the city. And in They Call Him Mr. Tibbs, he even has a family. Now, I'm pretty sure in that scene with Gillespie, they both talk about being slightly kindred spirits in that their work is their life. And they don't really... I mean, I might be wrong there, Russ, but I don't remember Tibbs talking about how he had a wife and two children.
Yeah, he says, have you ever been married? Or do you have kids? No. Have you ever been married? You know, how about close to it? It says close to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Well, yeah. If close to it means he's got a secret wife and kids who are about 10 years old in San Francisco, then that's what he means. And I watched that. I was like, how has he suddenly got children and a wife? And that film spends an inordinate amount of time in this really weird subplot in which Virgil is trying to teach his son essentially how to be a man and curb his bad behaviour by teaching him some awful habits. Like at one point, and with his daughter, it's similar. At one point, he comes home, he slaps his wife on the ass in front of his daughter, and his wife says, there's a time and a place, Virgil. And he says, oh, well, they say that if children see you being sexual with your wife, they'll grow up more sexually aware. Like, his wife's more, she's Yikes. Like, okay, yeah, right? Yeah. And I was watching it going, how is this in any way like related to what we saw before. And the organization, thankfully, ditches a lot of the family stuff, and it's got a better story. It actually has a little bit more going on. But equally, they both felt like films that really he could have been playing anyone. Like, you could have had Sidney Poitier play any kind of character. You could have started from scratch. He could have been called Bob Smith, right? Wouldn't have mattered. Wouldn't have mattered that he's Virgil Tibbs. It doesn't make any difference. He is not essentially the same character in a way. And I thought, what a wasted opportunity, you know, to actually, if you want to build a franchise around a character, it, you know, surely the logical expression would be to take him into a city environment and still have him face that sort of cauldron of repression and resentment and tension. But he doesn't. They call him Mr. Tibbs. He's like an episode of Columbo, right? Or a bad episode of Columbo, because Columbo's a good show, right? Nothing against Peter Falk, right? But imagine a bad episode of Columbo without Peter Falk. That is, they call me Mr. Tibbs. So, Ross, avoid. They are rubbish.
Good to know. Wow.
It's been great to discuss this with you in such depth, Ross. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been great, great. It's been a great conversation. So thank you very much for joining me.
Okay, that's all for today, listeners. My thanks to Tony and Russ for an interesting discussion. I'll be back with a new episode of The Movie Palace in October. Keep an eye on social media for more details as we get nearer to the time. At Movie Palace Pod on Twitter. You can also find the podcast on Facebook and Instagram. All right, let's hear about some of the other shows you can hear on the We Made This network.
Elsewhere on We Made This. We Buy Records.
The very idea of not indicating this is a reissue from this year, we would always write on the label the year if it's a reissue. If it's come in to us secondhand, you'd have to be a real shitbag, wouldn't you, to like put in a Smiths record and not point out, actually, this is the reissue from a couple of years ago.
Yeah, no, you would have to be. But we've seen all sorts of dodgy practices, so I wouldn't put it past someone to try it or to deliberately do that.
People are awful.
They are.
Motion pictures.
For that character, the character he plays, Norman, is someone who's held in such high regard by his friends, like decades after the fact, isn't he? By his colleagues from the army, you know, and they go back to find this gold and to pay their respects to him and stuff. You needed somebody who could kind of make that work, you know, somebody who had the charisma to really pull that off with just a few scenes, and I think he had that, you know. And I think, in a sad way though, like, I watched that film for the second time Saturday night, and
that was played really differently now, my god. Yeah,
retrospectively it's made even more poignant, because like his character, he's not gonna, you know, he's gonna forever be in our minds as a man about that age, you know. He's not gonna be able to grow old like his friends in the film did.
Amazing. Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
If you're trying to roll under something on 2d6, your average on 2d6 is 7. So if you've got a skill at, say, I don't know, 2 and a main stat at 2, you're going to be trying to roll a 4 or under on 2d6. That's a really quite tricky roll. And 2 and 2 is not necessarily a bad stat in this game either. Stats are quite low.
Yeah, they did seem to be that, yeah.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.